and the class. It's very helpful. It also looks quite good on your CV, actually, for later on, if you say you've been involved in stuff like this. So it's a nice thing to do. Don't hold back. I remember when I first started in first year, very, very shy, never got involved in anything very much. Well, maybe that's in some ways that's good. You know, you do your stuff and keep things going and so on. But it's also good to kind of look around a little bit. So if you have some inclination to do it, then don't hold back just because you're a first year. Just mail you in and you'll see how it goes. I think he's looking for something like 8 people, if I remember correctly. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing is, I think probably most people will be here. I'd like a little vote if I can, because I was contacted by one of the people in the ITO, the Informatics Teaching Organization on Level 4. They're the people who keep the administrative stuff straight. And she was saying, do you really want me to make paper copies of all of the lecture slides for the course? Because it's an awful lot of paper. And I first said, well, yes, because I just like to give everybody lots of paper slides. And I thought, well, actually, that is quite a lot of paper. Maybe I'd better ask and see whether it's really wanted. So if you want the paper, all I need to do is tell them to produce it. And that's fine. If not, no, and it's on the web. So it's a question. Ask away. That was your question. Yes. So your choice is, and this is what I'd like to vote on. Either the slides are on the web, you can go and look at them. As I said before, sometimes I do change them a little bit for the lectures that I'm going to give. So the slides that are on the web are the slides that I've got prepared now. So if I got hit by a bus, somebody else could come and give my lectures. But I change them a little bit sometimes because I think, oh, it'd be quite interesting to do this or that. So they may not be exactly what I give, but it's close enough. So anyway, they're on the web. You could just look at them electronically, keep electronic copies, or indeed print out your own copies. Or alternatively, I just get the ITO to print out a whole bunch of lecture slides and everybody gets a sheaf of all the lecture slides as paper. Which do you prefer? So who would, actually I only need to ask one thing. Who wants the paper copies? And no problem getting the paper copies, it's just what you prefer. But it's obviously wasteful if nobody wants paper copies for us to do lots of copies and waste paper. Which do you prefer? Who wants paper? Oh, actually, quite a lot. Right, we do paper. That's what we normally do. But I'm getting environmentally conscious a little bit. My first degree was in ecology. I have a degree in ecology.
Is there any news about where we can find the videos?
No, and that's a good question. And I'll tell you tomorrow. Because I actually don't know. I'll have to go and look at the URL. But they're there even for last year. Okay. Any more questions while we're at it? Just about the course. Sometimes I don't know the answer if it's something that's administrative. But anything else anybody wants to ask? No? Right. Okay. Let me. Is it lights? It's a little bit too light. Is it? Actually, I'm not sure that actually helped. How odd. That should dim the lighting, but it doesn't actually seem to. Oh well, that's not too bad. You can actually see, I guess. It's not too bad. Okay, so. So what I want to do in this lecture is to start you off on propositional logic. Remember last time I was talking, I gave you some predicate logic with all those connectives and variables and so on. I said, well, you don't need the variables. We'll just be using things where the predicates in there are just constants. And so we aren't talking about variables at all. So it's a simpler logic. And what I'll be doing is starting you into exploring things you can do, doing very elementary proofs in that logic. And it's the usual drill. So at the standard pattern, at the beginning, I'll give you a problem to solve, and then at the end we'll solve the problem. Actually, I'll give you two problems for this particular one. So here's the first problem. It's logic circuits. So suppose we're designing a couple of logic circuits. So logic, you know, you're going to build some bit of hardware, and you're going to have some circuit in, and the circuit is going to be a logic circuit because that's the way you build those things. And logic circuits have various logical connectives. And this is a little bit of a caricature, but kind of, it's not so far off. So we have one logic circuit that somebody's built, and it's got it has inputs and it has outputs. Okay, it's going to say signals coming in, signals coming out. And what the elements of the circuit do is they modify the signal. So if you have a not, what it does is it inverts the signal. So it turns it into the opposite of the input. So if the input was 0, the output would be 1. If the input is 1, the output is 0. If you have an OR, then what happens is if either one of the signals are a 1, it becomes a 1, let's say, where 1 is kind of, think of 1 as being like true, positive thing. Okay. And then we have another circuit here, which is same inputs, I1 and I2, same output, O1, but it's got a different internal structure. It's got a not coming through here, and then it's got an AND. For an AND, what happens is it signals 1 if it gets 2 1s on the input, otherwise it signals a 0. Okay. So that's different from OR, right? You think about OR as a bit like a logical OR, the sort of thing I was talking about in the previous lecture. Either one or both is enough to pass through. Think of AND as something where, like the logical AND, so you need to have both to pass the one through, and then not just inverts, like negation does in logic. That's why they're logic circuits, right? But here we have two circuits, same inputs, same output, different internal structure, and the question is, do we have really the same circuit? Why would that be an interesting question to answer? Well, that would be an interesting question to answer for a number of reasons. If you're building a larger circuit, then you quite like to know whether you've got the same device or not. Have I got the same component that I can put into this other device? Yes or no? And you want to be able to say, that thing I've got over here, even though it looks completely different, is actually doing completely the same thing. Another reason might be because we want to somehow simplify the circuit. So actually, this is a good point. If you were to walk out that door and walk across the road and into that big building over there and walk up one floor, you'd find a group that's building, actually they do a lot of circuit design, much more complicated of course than this. And as far as I'm aware, they have a circuit, they've built a little chip that's 20%, roughly, depending on how you count, more fuel economical than any other chip that you're going to be able to go out there and buy. Just right across the way there. And the reason they're able to do that is because they do an awful lot of reasoning about these kinds of designs. So this is an important issue for us. Here's another completely different problem, but we're going to use exactly the same methods to solve it. It's a little problem about common knowledge. This is you maybe have seen this problem before. It's used, you get it a lot as puzzles. So you have a husband. Imagine you have this kind of slightly strange society where you have husbands and wives, and any husband who's faithful to his wife gets shot on the day she finds that. That's what you have to do, right? So this is a hypothetical puzzle here. You'll see later on why it's important. I'm actually not going to explain to you why this puzzle is important at the moment. I'll explain to you at the end. For the moment, it's just a puzzle, right? And here's what happens. First day, you have three wives, and the three wives are told, I don't know, the policeman or something comes around and says, at least one of your husbands is unfaithful. I know one of your husbands is unfaithful, right? So that's a piece of true information. None of the wives knows whether her husband's unfaithful. You don't know, because they're too sneaky as a breed. But each one knows about the others, so you can see what the others are doing, but you know what the other husbands have been doing, other wives' husbands have been doing, but you don't know what your own one has been doing, right? Okay, so that's on day one. But you know one of them is. At least one is unfaithful, right? Then second day, and nothing happens on the first day. Okay, nobody gets shot the first day. Second day, three wives meet again. They find out that none of their husbands have been shot. And the third day, they meet again, find out nothing happened on the second day. Nobody got killed on the second day. That night, you're shooting. And the question for you is, how many husbands were unfaithful? So you should be able to answer that question. How many of you heard that puzzle before? You get it in lots of different forms. You have, actually not very many, so that's not such a bad one to use. So that'll exercise your brains thinking about how to work that one out. And I'll explain to you at the very end why actually that's quite an interesting puzzle to people who do informatics. Okay, so now what I have to do is introduce to you the notion of truth tables. So what a truth table is, so you've got a propositional logic. The nice thing is that, remember when we were talking about the variables and the quantifiers, and I would say, well, variables, it can be anything at all, and then you have quantifiers that say for anything you could possibly imagine and so on. Propositional logic isn't like that. We don't have variables. We don't have things that range over, you know, potentially infinite universes. We just have propositional things. So that means we can actually count up the truth values of the propositions. So suppose we have two propositions, P and Q. Doesn't matter what they are. They could stand for anything you want in the world. I know it. It's raining, Dave wears a coat, or whatever. No, anything you like. So we have P and Q. And you can just exhaustively enumerate all the possibilities for them being true or false. So these are Boolean logics. Something is either true or it's false. There's nothing in between. Okay. Right. So P, all the possibilities for all the combinations are P is true, Q is true. They're both P and Q are true. P is true, Q is false. P is false, Q is true. Or they're both false. Right. Those are the only possibilities we could possibly have in this little world where we've got P and Q to worry about. Okay, and so then what we want to do is, and now P and Q could be anything at all. So this is any proposition that we care to choose. Then we're interested in what do these connectives mean? Remember before I introduced the logical connectives? And so I'm going to talk about all of these logical connectives, the same ones that we went through in the last lecture. So I'm not going to go through the intuitions again this time. I just assume that you understand those. So not P is the negation of P. Okay, and so then what we have to define is what would we mean by the negation of P. So I think that's reasonably easy to do. It's like this. So because the negation of P just inverts the truth value, right? That's what negation means. So if P is true, not P must be false. So we get two falses here. If P is false, not P must be true, right? Happy with that. And what it means to put these truth values in here is I'm giving you what the semantics is actually for not, what not means. Actually, it doesn't matter what P is. P could be a much more complicated structure if I want it to. I could have other complicated things inside there talking about P. It doesn't matter. As long as I know what the truth value for P is, I can tell you what the truth value is for not P. You can use whatever symbols you want, but be unambiguous about it, actually. One of the things that you find, it's a good question. I've tried when I'm actually doing the lectures to be consistent with the notation I'm using. So you'll find that propositions tend to have lowercase letters. Things that aren't propositions tend to have uppercase letters. I tend to use not for a negation, and for a conjunction, or for disjunction, that for implication, and that for double implication. So that's what I do. But you do find lots of different notations being used. And what's important is just to be consistent and unambiguous about what you mean. So your question was, could you use a 0 and a 1 for this? Yes, yeah, sure, as long as 0 means whatever. Normally it would mean false, and 1 would mean true. Yeah. Okay, so there we are. That's not P and Q. Anybody want to take a guess at what the truth values might be for? So if P is Q and true and Q is true, what's P and Q? True. We'll do the rest. Any other time it's false. Because if either one is false, the whole thing must be false. Right? Because it's an and. They must both be true. Right? And it doesn't matter what P is or Q is. They can be individual propositions or more complicated things, as we'll see later. We know what happens to and, whatever happens to P and Q. Now let's do or. P or Q, if P is Q, true and Q is true. we said false. True. If one of them is false, still true. If both of them is false. Right. P implies Q is the one that, remember I said before, it causes people lots of grief. This is not going to work for everybody. Maybe let me try and see if I can explain to you a way to think about this. Now, to do that, I'm going to go on the board because it's nice to use a bit of chalk every now and again. Stop. Maybe a little higher. No, that's too high. Hey. Okay. And let's actually do the truth tables again. Let me explain to you a little bit more. So the reason why implication is really difficult for people is because people read too much into implication. Remember, these are formal languages. The reason why formal languages are called formal languages is very significant. They're called formal because the way you understand the truth or falsity of an expression depends entirely on its form. That's what formal means, right? Rather than being something where I appeal to some outside sense of what is right or what is wrong. All the inference I'm doing is based on the form of the expressions. It's a formal language. So when people look at implication, they think, oh, implication, it must mean everything that I understand about causality and so on, and pull in a whole lot of kind of intellectual baggage to do with the real world, which is a nice thing to do if you were really talking about, you know, the complexity of what causality is in the real world. But really, it's only expressing a correlation between the truth values of expressions. And if I say, P implies Q, what I'm really saying is it's not true that P can be true and Q is not true, right? So P is, if P implies Q, then it can't be true that P is true and Q is not true. You agree? That's what I'm saying, right? So what I'm really saying is not P and not Q. That's really what I'm saying. Okay, in terms of ands and nots, which we already talked about. So we know what ands and nots have as their truth values, right? Completely happy with the ands and nots and all of that. And you're completely happy that what I'm really saying when I'm saying implication is can't be true, that P is true and Q is not true, right? Completely happy about that, absolutely. Good, right. So, we'll do a truth table. And here's P, here's Q. Oh, and we need some rows in our truth table. That's going to be exactly the same as we had before. And we do it the same here, true, true, false, false, true, false, true, false. Is that right? Yeah, it looks pretty good. As long as I got all the combinations, it doesn't matter. Right, so each one of these rows gives me a particular combination of truth values for P and Q. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to work you out the truth value for this guy. Right, so remember I was saying with these things, it didn't matter what was inside the P's and Q's, I could tell you what the result is. So we've got various expressions here. We've got not Q, we've got P, and then we've got not of all of this. So I need to work out here what not Q is. So let's do this. Not Q. Right. What's that? You can tell me. So we're done. So now we know what the truth value is for not Q here. Now I want to know the truth value for P and not Q. P and not Q. Okay. So I've got P, not Q. Those are the two I'm looking at. P and not Q. False. True. So what's that? Right, and now I want the one for the whole thing, which is not P and not, I have to rub this out so I actually make space, and not Q. This is a big long truth table, but you'll see where I'm getting to in a moment. Okay, So that's, I'm taking not of all of that one, right? So what's that? Right? Okay? Happy with that? That made sense? And remember, that was, so this must be And probably now you go, what? Because you've got things where the ones that usually cause grief are the ones like this, where you say, when P is false and Q is true, whoa, this one is true. But it is because it means this. Right? This will cause some cognitive dissonance. It always does. Okay. So, but what you should do, the reason why it causes you some cognitive dissonance is because you're thinking implication means something a little bit more elaborate to do with causality somehow in the back of your mind. And somehow it's against the laws of the universe that this thing could possibly be true when you have some falsity involved in the expression. But it's not the case. This is not representing something like that. It's representing just the relationship between P and Q, the fact that you couldn't have P be true and Q not be true. Okay. So if you find that really difficult, what I thoroughly recommend is try working out this truth table for yourself and just go through it until you really feel that you understand that particular relationship. It is an important one, and it's a very fundamental one. Okay? Happy with that? Sorry, it is a little bit, it's quite a kind of, in some ways, this is quite a sort of clunky way of trying to convince you of that. And in some ways, it's the best possible example I can give you of the power of doing things like truth tables. Because it leaves, if what you're doing is defining that, what we've done here is we know exhaustively what the possible truth values are for these. We enumerate them all. We make commitments of what the truth values are for the connectives. And then having done that, we can say something about the truth values of everything else. And completely unambiguously, there is no room for argument because it's driven entirely off the form of the expression. Okay. Remember in the last lecture, I was talking a little bit about this, about the duality between what's true in the world and what's true inside the mathematical world that you build for yourself when you're doing this. And how you're always wrestling with that tension where you're doing things in practice. You wrestle with that tension because you always want the intuitions that you're trying to capture to conform to the inferences that your inference system can make. Many, many different kinds of inference systems. This is one of them. Mm-hmm.
Why is there a shorthand for such an obscure, is it commonly used?
Yes, because quite often, implication is a tremendously powerful notion, because what it says is that if you can find these things to be true, that's a very good question, because I didn't explain why you needed the connective. What it says is, if you can find these things to be true, then something else must inevitably follow. It cannot be the case that the thing here on the left-hand side is true, but this guy isn't. Or another way of looking at it, but it's a slightly different form of inference, is if I wanted to make this true, then it'd be a good idea to try and make this true. You'll see later on how we use that kind of notion. We make a lot of play on this as we go through. So implication is very, very powerful, it's very useful and appears in many, many inference systems. It's a very powerful sort of inference. We don't really need this operator, of course. Maybe that's the other thing that you're getting at. We could just leave it out and use nothing but ands and nots and so on, because they are equivalent. But trust me, when you come to write down some of these things, you'll want to use the implication because it's an easier way to think about it. Okay. So, there we go. Took us a while, but that's what you end up with for the truth values for implication. And I spent a bit of time going over that with you in depth, because I know from experience that some of you, if I'd just given you that, you'd have gone, I don't believe you. But you have to believe me, having seen what I just did. And then double implication, actually we don't need to dwell on that one. You can go and work that out for yourself, what that double implication, what does that actually mean? You actually go away and do this by yourself. I don't have time when I'm here, but you can work it out using a truth table if you know that P, that's the same as, and go away and work out the truth value for that expression. It's the same as that, and it'll end up being what that is. And if it doesn't, then the whole edifice of propositional logic comes crashing down. Mm. Not quite, because we're not equals is a sort of loaded term. I almost said yes because it's the easy thing for me to say, but it's not quite the same. What you're showing us is that you've got equivalence between P and Q, and we're not. Just take it as equivalence rather than equal to. But I wouldn't worry too much about the distinction, actually, for our purposes.
You were saying that the P implies Q idea doesn't really fit with a lot of people's idea, really. Mm. But in ways it kind of does, because if you said, if something is yellow and something is a banana, then something is yellow implies it's a banana. Mm. But if something is not yellow, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a banana.
Yes.
So it does work.
Yes. Yes, I mean, in some cases it does. I mean, that is the other way that you can take a run at it. It works in precisely the case where this is what you mean. and in other cases, it may not work quite so well for you. I don't want to spend a lot of time kind of digging into it, but I mean, there are actually subfields of informatics where people do worry about exactly how to represent causality and all that entails. Which is really quite a lot, but there's absolutely no chance that we can get into that in this particular course. You might touch on it in honors years. Right. So let me rush on a bit. Okay. So there's some other consequences that flow from this. So, or at least other concepts. One concept is inconsistency. So now you actually are in a position that you could take any one of these propositional formulas. Doesn't matter how complicated the structure is, right? It could have all sorts of substructure in it. As long as it's using all the connectives, which you now know what they mean, you could always tell me what the truth value is for the big expression. Every time. Doesn't matter how complicated it is. So since you've got that, then you can start to think, if I took an expression and I did that for every possible truth value, what would the truth value for the whole expression be? And if the truth value is always false, that's an inconsistency. It means that there is no way that I can assign truth values to the propositions, the atomic propositions in the expression, and the expression turns out to be true. So a simplest example is this one. So if I say P and not P, there is no way that under any interpretation of P that can be true. Because when it's true, the whole thing's false. When it's false, the whole thing's false. It's just inconsistent expression. Okay. Another one is a contingent expression. So a contingent expression is one where you get different values depending on the truth values you gave to the atomic proposition. So for example, if I say P or Q implies P, then if P and Q are both true, then the whole thing turns out to be true. Sorry, maybe I should explain this notation. I assumed it was fairly intuitive, but let's just admit. I mean, all this is doing is showing you, given the sub-expressions, what the truth values are, and then showing you how they propagate through the big expression. Could have drawn a big truth table, but it's easier to draw on a diagram like that. Okay. Or if P is false and Q is true, so here P is false, Q is true, then the whole thing turns out to be false. So it's contingent. Depends on the truth values you assign to the primitive expression. Or, surprise, surprise, the other option is it's a tautology. And a tautology is one where it doesn't matter what truth values you assign to the primitive expressions, always the whole expression turns out to be true. So if you say P and P implies Q, that's always true. Right? So you can play around with this and see, and you have these different concepts. Sometimes things are always true, sometimes things are always false, sometimes they're contingent. Right. What I want now to do is to step through solving these problems, which means doing a little bit of actually the things that I was talking about in the previous lecture and the things I've been talking about now. So we'll take our time going through these. First one is the logic circuits. So here are the circuits that I started off with, and they were things that I was talking about in the hardware world. Now, what we need to do if we're going to tackle this using truth tables, is we're going to turn them into something that's in our formal language so that we can use just the form of the expressions in order to reason about them. And we want to make sure that that step works well. Otherwise, it doesn't matter what we're doing in our formal language, it'll still be wrong in some sense. So actually, for these, it's pretty straightforward. This is the most straightforward example I could easily think of, actually, because we don't have a tremendous amount of ambiguity in how we do this translation, because we can just take each one and say it maps onto a logical expression to this guy, and very conveniently, there's only one output. So I can think of the output as being like the truth value for the whole expression. This is the trick that I'm going to now pull on you. So O1 is like the truth value for the whole expression. When I described it initially, I was saying zeros and ones, but it could have been trues and falses. Okay, so let's say this is something that can be either true or false, so can this, and it's the output for the whole expression. These guys are like the primitive expressions. I can assign truth values to do. It's going to be either zero or ones equals true or falses, right? So if that's true, then I need to think how these things map onto the connectives, and it's absolutely straightforward because I set it up that way. So I should build up the structure. So this is not I1. There it is. And I take that and I have it in an OR with I2. So I have not I1 or I2 is my expression in propositional logic. Happy about that? Just straightforward. This one, I do the same thing. So I've got not I2. There it is. And then I take an AND of it with I1. I1 and not I2. And then this guy inverts it. All I'm doing is really I'm following through the graph here and constructing the expression. So here I have it's a tree. I have a tree-like expression going not and not. Here I have a tree, and I have not and not. Completely happy about that? Right, just isomorphic structures. Right, so now this is very conveniently inside my lovely formal world where I can then start reasoning about things. And I want to know where these two guys are equivalent. So I use my truth table. So here, let me see, let me just check where I am. Not I1 or I2. Okay, so that's one circuit, and that's the other one, right? There's my not I1 or I2. There's my not I1 and not I2. I set up my truth table. I have I1 and I2, so it's very like what I'm doing with identical to what I'm doing with the P's and Q's here. And I set these up. Okay, so now we solve it. So not I1 is going to be what? Okay. Not I2 is going to be. Okay, so then I want to know this guy. Have a think about it. Take your time. It's quite good for you to work this one out. You just do a little bit of thinking about what that turns out to be. All you're doing is taking that one there and the OR with that one there. General mutterings. I have no idea what you're saying, but that's what I believe the answer to be. Okay, so not I1 is false, or I2 is true. So true and false, and it's an OR, so it must be true. This one I've got not I1 is false, I2 is false, false or false is false, and so on through. Okay. On to the next one. I1 and not I2. Have a think about that one if you're not already ahead of me. Okay, so we've got I1 and not I2. So I1, not I2, those are the two columns we're interested in. And it's an AND. So we've got true and false is false. True and true is true. False and false is false. False and true is false, because it's an AND. Okay? So that gives us the truth values for this. So now the last one. So we've got I1 and not I2. There it is. And I want to invert that. So it's this. So false turns to true, true to false, false to true, false to true. Right? And now I just, so this was my first circuit, this is my second circuit, and you look. So these are all the possibilities for I1 and I2, and every time they coincide. So those two circuits are logically equivalent. Doesn't matter which one I use, and if I'm an engineer, I have to make some other decision about which one's the best structure. Maybe I'm building a hardware circuit and one uses less power than the other. Or maybe for some reason it fits better on the chip or whatever.
Okay. Is that the same as saying I1 implies I2?
No. Because, well, in a number of different ways it's not. In a number of different ways it's not. So what you're doing here is saying, yes, so what you're doing here is taking the structure of one expression and relating it to the structure of the other. So you're saying the truth values that I can get, regardless of how I do inference on this one, are going to be the same as the ones I get, regardless of how I do inference on this other one. That doesn't say anything about the relationship between I1 and I2. In some ways, these are the things that are saying that determining the relationship between I1 and I2. So if you said I1 implies I2, actually it's describing something about the world that you're reasoning about, which would be you'd add in another axiom to describe that. So it doesn't mean that I1 implies I2. Okay. Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that. So that's the connection. Okay. I put this slide in just because I felt like saying it. There's no particular reason to absorb this in this lecture, but it's worth mentioning, I think. Another way that you can look at whether circuits are equivalent, we'll touch on this later on, I kind of wanted to sensitize you to this, is just by looking at the equivalences between the expressions. Remember in the first lecture I mentioned that you had equivalences between expressions, and in fact I used equivalences between expressions to convince you of what this means. I said, oh well, that must be equivalent to that, right? It means the same thing. Always the truth values will be the same. That's kind of one of the nice things about logics of this kind is that they're monotonic. I can define the connectors and I can say I don't care what's inside the connectors as long as I know the truth values for the things. I don't care what the structure is. The truth value of the expression that I'm using to build the larger one is always the same. It doesn't change. It's not sensitive to what's inside other than through their truth values. That means you can substitute expressions. You can take one expression, if you knew you've got the same one, you can pull out that bit of an expression and push in the one that means exactly the same, and you've still got the same meaning for the bigger expression, which is a lovely thing to have. You so seldom have that in real software. It'd be wonderful if it was true. If it was true in real software, you could just incrementally build everything, and the world would be a marvelous place. Well, maybe the world would be a worse place, but you'd certainly have the ability to build a lot more software, a lot more effectively. So anyway, so let's try and do a little bit of that with this. And you don't need to understand this in any great depth. So if you've got, here are our two circuits. And I can say that I2 here is actually equivalent to the double negation of I2. If I negate the negation of something, it's the same as the thing on the inside. Not I2 is the same as just saying I2. It's not true that I2 is not true. Right? You can play around with the truth table for that if you want to convince yourself of that equivalence. Actually, that's the other thing about equivalence. You can demonstrate equivalences by a truth table, and then the equivalence always holds. So then you know, and you can apply the same rewrite every time. Okay, so now I can say that not I1 or not I2 is equivalent to not I1 and not I2. I've got not I2 on both sides, so let's just call it B, just to make the expression a little simpler, okay, because it's the same thing. So I've got not I1, so now I know that not I1 or not B is equivalent to not I1 and B. Which is another equivalence. Go if for fun, if you don't believe that equivalence, intuitively it's true. Not something or not something is equivalent to not the conjunction. If you don't quite believe it, do the truth table and find out that you get the same truth values all the time. Since those two are equivalent, now we know the whole thing is equivalent because we've taken it down to the kind of most primitive equivalences. So you can do that kind of thing instead of doing a truth table. Oh, sorry, this is this. Right, there we go. How are we doing for time? Oh yeah, okay. Okay, so now down to the last problem, which is this puzzle. So we have a husband, unfaithful to his wife, shot by her on the day she finds out. Okay, so now what I'm doing now, you already had a little time to kind of mull that over in the back of your minds when you were listening to me talking about other things. But now you can really think about it. So let me pull out some of the pieces of information that are very important for you when you're thinking about this. Some of you maybe already solved the problem because you happen to think about things just exactly that way. For others, it will be still cryptic. So we have three wives. Each one knows about the others. So each one can, so that's very important. Each one can know something about the others, although you don't know something that same thing about yourself. So that's why it's a common knowledge problem. So that to solve this problem, it is necessary for the other wives to know something about the others that they don't know about themselves. And that's pivotal to solving the problem. Day two, they meet. Day three, they meet. And then they're shooting. And then there's the question. Right. Actually, if you look in the notes, you find a much longer, maybe some of you already have looked in the notes, you find a much longer truth table. It's a horrendously long truth table doing all the combinations of and. So cheat one, cheat two, and cheat three mean cheat one means husband one is cheating, cheat two means husband two is cheating, cheat three means husband three is cheating. So we've got, I can push this, what did I just do? Stop. We've got, here are the wives. Each one has a husband. And each wife, am I doing this right? If I got enough arrows here, let me see, and then this has to go there. This has to go, have I got that right with the right number? Each one can see the other, right? Okay. Cheat one means, let's number them. One, two, three. Cheat one means the husband of that wife, and that wife doesn't know anything about what that husband is doing, is cheating. Cheat two means the husband of that wife, who can't know what the husband is doing, is cheating. Cheat three, third one, right? And then we can look at, so then there are, we can enumerate all the possibilities. So one possibility is all of these husbands are cheating. One, two, three. They're all cheating swine, and that's what the issue is. Or we can have any other combination. So it could be any two of them. So these are any two. So it's one and two, or one and three, and so on. Or it could be just one. So it could be just husband one, or whatever. Or it could be that none of them are cheating, actually. Oh yeah, yeah, but wait a minute. I'm enumerating all the possibilities. We get to it. Okay, so could it be none? Let's say that because we're enumerating all the truth values, including one that we're going to exclude through the problem, right? Okay, so in fact, that's the first thing we know. So on day one, and this is this is interesting for the following reasons. So on day one, what we had to do to solve this problem was somebody had to come in and actually inject a piece of information into the system. That piece of information was there is at least one. And what that allows you to do is in this truth table, it's the bigger truth table in the notes just gives all the combinations of cheat one and cheat two and cheat three and cheat one, you know, all of that. So you can look at all the possible logical combinations. I won't do that because I can't fit it on the slide. So I'm giving you it a little bit more intuitively here. But in the notes, you can find the whole thing worked out. Day one, we're just told that it has to be at least one. So essentially, we exclude that row in the truth table. It can't exist. Okay. Right. So what happens is then, each one of these wives, and remember, each one of these wives is looking at all it can get information on the other wives, knows that there must be at least one husband who's a cheating husband. And if I'm wife H3, I can know what the husbands of the other wives are doing. And I know there must be at least one. So they go away, but then nobody is shot. So then we can exclude this row in the truth table, where it's true for only one. And the reason why is because they knew, all these wives on the first day knew it had to be at least one. And they can see the other wives. So if any of these wives were to look out at the other wives and see that their husbands were faithful, they would know it had to be theirs. Right? Question.
Do the wives know how many husbands are cheating?
Yes. Okay. Well, so no, do you know how many husbands are cheating? Do you know how many there are in total? So it's n is 3. So size 3, it isn't some infinite size. Okay? So they can look at, and they can look at it, all the other ones. It doesn't matter how big n is. So they can look at it, all the other ones, and knowing that there's at least one, which they were told at the beginning, and knowing that none of the other ones, and knowing that it is not the case that all the others are faithful, right? You look at it, and you don't see that all of the other husbands are faithful. That must have happened, right? Because none of them got shot. Happy about that? This is the bit that makes it the sort of thing that people like as an interesting puzzle, because it's kind of counterintuitive. It's relying on knowing what's not true about the system, right? So I'm a wife. First day, I know there's at least one. I look at it, and I don't see that everybody else is completely faithful. That tells you two things. Says something to the wife, because she doesn't shoot, right? No wife shoots. And the reason why must be because each one of those wives looked at and saw that it wasn't completely okay with the rest of the wives, right? So otherwise, she would have known immediately that everybody else is okay. I know there's at least one. Bang. Right? So that would have happened the first day. Right? So you know that to be true. It's really quite interesting because it's not just what you find out immediately. Then, because there's no shooting, of course, the other wives now know something. They know something about what the other wives know, because nothing happened. Because nothing happened, if I met this wife, nothing happened because I saw that there was something going on elsewhere, right? That first day. Now, as soon as the other wives get back the next day, the other wives know that this wife knew that. So they know something a little bit more about themselves because of what the other wives didn't do. Right? Right? This is the crucial thing. And then nothing happens the other day either. So now knowing that from the previous day, what actually happened was when we were at day 2, we know it's not just that there's one, it's more than one. And yet you can still look around, and you can know how many, right? Because it's a band, you know how many of the unfaithful husbands there are in the rest of the population, right? And so every wife is now counting, okay? And she can look around, okay? And this works for N. And then actually by this time, if the wives are acting completely rationally, they've hit the only possible option in the truth table. Right? It's the only one left. So, I'm afraid, that's what has to happen. And that's how you solve that problem. It is a kind of counterintuitive problem. If you start looking at, let me get on to why this is important. We don't have much time, but let me just do this. So, this problem is really important for people who are thinking about taking very big distributed systems and sharing knowledge. Because what's happening on a small scale there is you have individual agents, people, who have very limited knowledge about their own environment and very limited ways of being able to see the environment around them. And actually, pretty much that's how the internet is. If you're sitting as a process on the internet, you're a little process. You know some things about yourself, maybe not everything about yourself. You can see some things externally, but not everything. And an awful lot of what you're seeing, I'm actually using through your devices, is people building up little stores of knowledge, and they're opening them up in different ways to other devices on the internet. Okay. Probably one of the more ambitious versions of this is the semantic web, which some people believe will be very successful, other believe will be a complete disaster, and somewhere in between, no doubt, there is some truth. I don't know, you might even have heard of the semantic web. How many have heard of things like that? Semantic web, that kind of thing? A little bit, not too much, about half. Okay. So basically the idea of the semantic web is you take web pages and then you start marking them up, trying to represent formally, and actually in languages that look quite a lot like the sort of logic languages that you've seen. They are more elaborate because they're oriented to using the various protocols on the web, but also different. You build up services, computer programs that's pushing out more of that kind of what people often call metadata, information about what it is that they can do. And then you're trying to use those kinds of representations to connect up the devices so that those devices will interoperate rather more easily than they have done in the past, when all they had was some string and you didn't know what it was that you were having to deal with. So you can do much more automation of that sort. And an interesting question is that actually going to work? If we start, actually probably a more realistic question is, to what extent can that work? What's the limit to which we can share that kind of knowledge and still be able to do it reliably? So we don't have time in this lecture course to really dig into that. But I hope I've convinced you that the sort of things that you do here in understanding things in logic are the kind of most primitive things that you can know as essentials for trying to tackle those kinds of problems. Okay, just to finish up, here are things I think you should practice, because it's good to start practicing these things now. Big mistake that people sometimes make in courses like this one, because remember, this is a technical course, so there are technical skills you need to master. There's not a huge big set of them. It's not so completely, not terribly difficult to do, but you do need to practice. So get going. Practice writing down some things in compositional logic. You'll get some practice in the tutorials too next week. Working at truth values and understanding equivalences. Thank you very much, and see you tomorrow.
Circuit for P implies Q and vice versa.
P implies Q implies, sorry.
P and Q imply each other. I couldn't figure out how to do that as a logic circuit.
P implies Q and Q implies P. So, do you have a pen? So what you want is simply this. Is this P implies? Oh, you want to go the other way. So you want P implies Q and Q implies P.
Yeah, so it's just the double.
So that could be, well, there's different ways. One, you could write it as an equivalent thing, so you could have not. So I'll use this funny cleft thing for not, because it's easier for me to write. Not P or Q, and not Q or P. That would be another way of doing it. So now it's all nots and ors and ands, and you can write it that way. So I just take out the implication, turn it into that. And there you are. So then this would be. So that's P. That would be a not, right? Not. That goes into an or. Right, and that's Q. Right, and then we get an and. And then you do the same with this one over here.
Well, but how do you do it? Well, my problem is how you do it with two inputs, because I can understand how to do it with four inputs if you just input them each twice, because you can do this AND gate and this
not
OR.
Just connect them up. That'd be okay.
Okay, so
it doesn't need to be a pure tree as long as it ends up being, yeah.
Okay. Hey, I have a question about class reps. I still didn't quite understand how they nominated or how.
Well, I have to admit, I don't know either necessarily. What I hear from you, because I don't organize it, but what I believe from Ewan is you just mail, I'm trying to remember, what is it? Email is Ewan, E-W-A-N, at, I think inf will do, inf.ed.ac.uck. You just mail him and say, I'd like to be a class rep.
Okay.
And that should do it. and then he'll get back to you. I think that's the way he's doing it. In previous years, we used to do elections in the lecture theater. I remember running one of those. But I think he prefers to do it by email this year, so that's fine.
Okay. Thanks.
Should we do the tutorial exercise for Tuesday?
Yes, because they are next week, yeah. Yeah, there's the first. Yeah, I mean, basically the dates that were... Oh, sorry, will I...
All right.
No, I'll and I should clean the board for you.
No, that's right, I'm not using the board.
Oh, really?
No,
okay.
I'll just be using this.
Lovely, thank you. That's all right. Hello.
I'm going to have to leave a little bit early, if that's all right.
Okay. Well, if you could sort of sit somewhere where you can slip out unobtrusively,
yeah, right,
that would be best. Lovely, thank you.